Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extraordinary public challenge by the newly appointed White House head of communications, who is accusing Trump's chief of staff, Reince Priebus, of possibly being, quote, a senior leaker, who should, quote, explain that he is not a leaker, adding that he's going to need to speak for his own actions. Joining us is Paul Waldman, a weekly columnist and senior writer for The American Prospect, where he has an article, At Last Trump Finds His Mini-Me, Anthony Scaramucci Perfectly Embodies the Trump Administration. We'll discuss the open warfare and public humiliation going on in this chaotic White House and what appears to be a parallel effort with Trump trying to force his Attorney General Sessions to quit while Scaramucci tries to force Trump's Chief of Staff Priebus out in order to take his job. Then we'll examine Trump's reckless practice of government by tweet, now that it is clear the Commander-in-Chief ignored his chain of command in announcing transgender Americans will no longer be allowed to serve in the U.S. military. A former Assistant Secretary of Defense, Lawrence Korb, a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information and author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction, joins us to discuss the danger of having a leader who has shown he could just as well order a nuclear attack without consulting his Secretary of Defense or Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Then finally, Peter Afasiabi joins us in the studio. He founded an appellate litigation clinic for civil rights and political asylum in conjunction with the University of California, Irvine School of Law, and is the author of the new book just out, Burning Bridges, America's 20-Year Crusade to Deport Labor Leader Harry Bridges. We will discuss the relentless efforts by the government and an obsession on the part of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to tie Harry Bridges to the Communist Party in order to deport him for being a champion of the West Coast longshoremen and an honest, incorruptible labor leader. And joining us now is Paul Waldman, a weekly columnist and senior writer for The American Prospect. He also writes for the Plumline blog at The Washington Post and The Week, and he's the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And his latest article at The American Prospect is At Last, Trump Finds His Mini-Me, Anthony Scaramucci Perfectly Embodies the Trump Administration. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Waldman.
Thank you.
And Anthony Scaramucci, Donald Trump's newly hired communications director, has said he has a very good idea who the senior leakers are at the White House. He tweeted that out and then subsequently deleted the tweet. But he also said, talking about Reince Priebus, if Reince wants to explain that he's not a leaker, let him do that. He's going to need to speak for his own actions. Now, that's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And he did this unbelievable interview calling it to CNN, where he practically declared war on Priebus, who is technically his boss. At one point, he was asked about the leaks, and he said, and I'm quoting here, "The fish stinks from the head down, but I can tell you two fish that don't stink, okay? That's me and the president." So that's sort of a direct accusation that Priebus is leaking things. And, you know, there's something I think that's really compelling about Scaramucci is that, like everybody else in that kind of a job, he's going to offer you the spin, but he also has these moments of sort of shocking candor that pull you up short. And this is really one of them. But I don't think that, you know, one of the things that people have suggested is that just in the course of a few days, you know, he's been everywhere in the media, and we know that President Trump can get a little jealous if somebody is stealing his spotlight. A lot of people think that's what happened with Steve Bannon, that he kind of incurred Trump's ire because he was on the cover of Time magazine and he was getting too much attention. But I think what Scaramucci really understands well is that as long as you have no agenda other than the aggrandizement of Donald Trump, then you can be safe no matter how much attention you get. So if you watch him giving these interviews, he always talks about how much he loves Donald Trump and how Donald Trump is the smartest person he's ever met, and he's so extraordinary and so amazing. And so if the president is watching him on TV, no matter how much the spotlight is on him, he's going to be happy with what Scaramucci is doing.
Well, but is there a kind of tag team going on here? Donald Trump is clearly putting public pressure and humiliation on his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, forcing him to quit. He obviously doesn't want to fire him. He wants to humiliate him into quitting. Is that also what Scaramucci is doing? Is there a tag team going on here to fire Priebus as well?
Well, you know, Priebus's his position has been sort of tenuous for a long time. There are constant reports from inside the White House that Trump is talking to people about firing him and exploring who he might replace him with. You know, Priebus was not a, sort of an original Trump loyalist. He came on fairly late. He had been the chairman of the Republican Party, and he was brought in to be chief of staff because, you know, it was assumed that you needed somebody who was more experienced in that job. Now, the truth is that Priebus had never held a position in government, so he didn't exactly have the right experience. But he's always been suspect in Trump's eyes. And I think that, you know, you can look at this and it's hard to tell if when he says these kinds of things, Scaramucci is doing Trump's bidding or if he's just kind of acting on his own. But he obviously feels secure enough in his own position that he's able to take these kinds of swipes at Priebus. And, you know, maybe he's right about that. Maybe Trump has so much affection for him that in this war between the two of them, that Scaramucci's confident he'll come out on top. And Scaramucci even said in that CNN interview, he said, "I don't know if this is repairable or not," meaning the relationship between him and Priebus, "but that will be up to the president." So, you know, if it comes down to Priebus saying, you know, it's him or me, I guess Scaramucci thinks that he's going to be the one left standing at the end.
Well, he might have well gotten some assurances along those lines, if that's indeed he's being the hitman. I guess Trump can't humiliate two of his closest aides at once, can he?
Well, it's
maybe
tell,
not.
But we're gonna, you know, there will no doubt be more and more leaks, and this is obviously something that Scaramucci himself is livid about the amount of leaks that come out of the White House. But it's just amazing how much just kind of chaos there is there. You know, we've never seen anything like this before. You know, all White Houses leak a little bit; they have their, you know, their hiccups and their stumbles. But this White House just seems to be in complete chaos. There's, you know, these internal wars that are spilling out into public. You know, I can't recall ever a time when a president of the United States has been sort of publicly trying to humiliate one of his cabinet members, as you saw. You had this incident with Trump making this kind of sweeping policy change on transgender people in the military via a tweet or a series of tweets, and apparently the Pentagon had no idea that it was coming.
Sure.
There was the really curious thing where he said half of the policy in one tweet, then there was a 9-minute pause before he actually revealed what it was he was going to be saying, and there have been reports that people at the Pentagon thought that maybe he was invading North Korea, and they were just waiting for those 9 minutes to try to figure out what it was all going to be about. They didn't know about it. Trump's own spokespeople can't explain how it would work. And it's just this extraordinary situation. Also, Secretary of Defense James Mattis was on vacation while this was happening, and he apparently didn't approve it. And, you know, this is something I noted today in something I wrote. He was on vacation. Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, is also on vacation. Now, we're only 6 months into this administration. I haven't taken a vacation yet, and my job is much less important than theirs.
Right.
So why do people keep leaving town in the middle of all these events? This is,
right.
this, you know, it's just another indication of how crazy things are with the
sure.
Trump administration.
Sure, and we'll be covering that with the former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the next segment. But need I just remind our audience that Donald Trump has the fate of the world at his fingertips. He has the nuclear codes. So there was dissent. Priebus, who Scaramucci is openly attacking in this extraordinary way that we've already discussed, he was against it. Spicer quit over Scaramucci's appointment. Apparently Stephen Bannon and I think others in the White House thought it was a bad idea. It seems to me that the reason they thought it was a bad idea was the place was screwed up enough without putting in an enabler. Because that's what he is, isn't he? Isn't this guy a Trump enabler? And if you look at the minute since he's been in there, things have gotten even more chaotic.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about this position, the White House Communications Director, it's normally held by somebody who is an old hand, who has, you know, a decade or two of experience in managing press relations, in political strategy. But Scaramucci doesn't have any of that. You know, he's a hedge fund guy. But how did he get the job? Well, he got the job in the same way that many people have gotten jobs in the Trump administration, which is that Trump saw him on TV. And he is, I think, in some ways, sort of a perfect embodiment of that cable TV ethos, in that, you know, he may not have a lot of knowledge or a lot of insight, but he says everything emphatically and with absolute confidence, no matter what he's saying. And so he's very good, you know, he's very good in those kind of cable shout fests. And that really attracted Trump to him. And I think that, you know, when Trump wants an advocate, he wants somebody who will be that sort of right up in your face. Everything that he says will be with complete confidence. I mean, if you think about Sean Spicer, you know, Sean Spicer lied a lot on Trump's behalf, but you could always tell that he knew that you knew that he was lying. You know, like you could see it on his face, this kind of discomfort with the whole exercise. I don't say that to excuse it. You know, if you go to work for Donald Trump, you know what you're getting yourself into. But it was kind of painful. Sure. And that made it a lot less less persuasive. And I think that was part of what led to Trump being so dissatisfied with Spicer, is that he just didn't have that kind of enthusiasm for defending him.
Right.
And when Scaramucci does it, like, he looks like he could not be having a better time. When he goes out there and says how much he loves Trump and how Trump is the most fantastic human being he's ever met, you can see that he feels it. And to a great extent, anyone who advocates for the Trump administration has an audience of one. They know that the president is watching. And when he watches Scaramucci, I'm sure he just right. couldn't be more pleased.
Right. He's not doing his job as president. He's watching television. It's pretty extraordinary. But, you know, I felt so, and a lot of people did, I think, feel sorry for Spicer. And you could tell that he was tortured. And on his day one, he had to lie in this ludicrous way about the size of the inauguration crowd. And he, of course, he's a very good Catholic. I think he knew that he was sinning. But that leads me to comment that, you know, Spicer desperately wanted to meet the Pope, and Trump wouldn't let him. Instead, he wanted a photo op with his own family. So, not a nice.
Yeah, man, that was a really extraordinarily petty kind of thing that they, you know, they had this trip to the Pope, and there were a certain number of aides who were going to be allowed to come in, and there would have been plenty of room for him. But as you say, Spicer is a devout Catholic. Trump knew that. It would have meant a lot to him, and he intentionally, you know, struck him from the list. And it just seems like just another kind of the ways that that Trump tries to humiliate the people who work for him to sort of show his dominance over everybody. It cannot be a very fun place to work, especially now.
And in your article, Paul Wolman, at the American Prospect, at last Trump finds his mini-me, Anthony Scaramucci perfectly embodies the Trump administration. You point out that they both share this outer borough envy, one that is simultaneously contemptuous of the aristocratic elite and desperate to show that he's an elite too. And of course, we've noticed that Scaramucci was quick to point out that he went to Harvard Law School, and as Donald Trump keeps talking about how brilliant he is because he went to Wharton. This guy doesn't have, obviously, is not as thin-skinned, though, as he is Trump. I mean, Trump is really alarmingly thin-skinned. Do you think that he can ride it out just by, as you pointed out, you know, he can say anything on TV with complete confidence, no matter how absurd it is. Do you think he's going to survive here? Because my sense is that, as I mentioned before, I think things have gotten more chaotic. Even these people, as much as a lot of people don't like the Bannons of this world, it looks as if Bannon and company knew that this was a bad idea. It does seem to already be clear to me that it's a terrible idea to have an enabler of a president who should be reined in, who's incredibly undisciplined, if not self-destructive. It seems to me that the trajectory is not looking good for Trump.
Yeah, well, you know, you never know. Maybe things will calm down. And in that kind of a role, you know, he really only has one person he has to satisfy. You know, you're seeing some interesting conflicts in other areas. We've talked about what's going on with Jeff Sessions. That, unusually, has actually caused some backlash among Republicans in Congress. You know, they've been so quiet about objecting to anything that Trump does. But in this case, There have been senators who have been publicly raising objections to the way Sessions is being treated because, you know, he's a former colleague of theirs and they like him. And also, he's somebody who is really enacting a conservative agenda. You know, amidst all this chaos, there are a few areas in which there is actually a lot of things getting done. The Justice Department is one of them. The way I put it today was that Sessions is kind of building a bridge to the 1950s. You know, he's trying to roll back civil rights protections and voting rights protections and bring back the drug war of the 1980s. And so he has been extremely active. You know, so I think that a lot of those very conservative Republicans in Congress are upset at the idea that he might be shoved aside. But for someone like Scaramucci, you know, he's a White House staffer. And even if he causes these little problems, you know, that kind of occupy our attention for a few days at a time, in the end, you know, there may be nobody who is out to get him who's outside of the White House. And if he can, you know, if he can win this battle with Reince Priebus, then he could be top dog. You know, when he got hired, there were some reports from journalists who had talked to people in the White House who said that he was being groomed to take over as chief of staff. So that could be the end result of this before long, is that he could wind up chief of staff and then he'd be in charge of the place. And besides Trump, there'd be no one who could tell him that he wasn't doing a good job.
Well, that does seem to be in the cards, but just in terms of what you mentioned about Sessions, it is an extraordinary situation to be in, and I make no secret of the fact that I'm appalled by this presidency. But the choice that we have is to keep Jeff Sessions, a relic of the Jim Crow South, turning back the clock, or having Donald Trump escape justice.
Yeah, and you know there are questions about what would happen if he did fire him. I think that even Republicans would be worried about that. There have been a couple, you know, people who have been critical before, like Lindsey Graham, who have said that, you know, it would be a real crisis if he fired Sessions. And let's not forget that if he did, it would be specifically because Sessions chose not to protect him in the Russia investigation. Like that's the whole point. That's what Trump is angry about. And so if that happened and he nominated somebody else to be attorney general, there would be no doubt that that person would have to make public pledges that he would not interfere with that investigation. And that would be a real problem, because that would be the whole reason that that person, whoever he or she might be, would become the attorney general. So that could become a real crisis.
But just in terms of the overall picture here, it feels as though they're circling the wagons, the circle's getting narrower. It's going to come down to, particularly if Priebus is forced out and Scaramucci becomes the chief of staff, it's going to come down to the uber-loyalists, the ultra-ultra-loyalists, and the family. And that'll be it, right? I mean, do you get the feeling that they're circling the wagons, that that's the trajectory they're on?
Well, it's possible. There are only so many of those people, you know? One thing that a point that I would make about Bannon, who got, you know, who kind of got sidelined a little bit, who got his wings clipped, I think part of the reason may be that Trump saw him as someone who had his own agenda and beyond just boosting Donald Trump. You know, Bannon has this very well thought out philosophy of white nationalism, and he saw Trump as a vehicle to, you know, help advance that, you know, very cleverly, obviously. But it's his own agenda. And to a certain degree, Jeff Sessions has his own agenda. I don't think Trump, you know, cares much one way or the other about the things that Sessions is actually doing at the Justice Department. You know, as you say, a certain number of people, like the members of his own family who were there, their only agenda is boosting Donald Trump. That seems to be the case with Scaramucci, too. That may end up being, the only people who are left are the people who are left in that inner circle. And that was I think, a reason why Trump was always suspicious of Reince Priebus, because he's, you know, kind of a longtime Republican operative, the kind of person who was there before Donald Trump came to Washington and will be there after Donald Trump leaves Washington. And Trump doesn't really trust those people. You know, they're the establishment. The people that he trusts are the people who have no purpose other than, you know, the glorification of Donald Trump. And there aren't that many of them.
Well, just in closing, Paul Waldman, what do you make of this paradox that this is a man who is incredibly nasty to people and is totally self-obsessed and has a frail ego at the same time, rampant narcissism. What's going on in terms of that paradox that he treats people so poorly yet wants to be loved?
Yeah, it is kind of remarkable. I think that there are going to be 100 books written exploring his particular psychology. But you're absolutely right. He's, you know, he demands complete loyalty from others and gives loyalty to almost no one. As soon as you show the slightest bit of evidence that you have some purpose other than than his glorification, you're likely to get shut out. And it's extraordinary that he managed to become president of the United States. I mean, I think there are probably other people who have been successful in business who have the same kind of personality. But it was an extraordinary confluence of circumstances that led him to have the opportunity to actually win the presidential election. And now we'll all be living with it for at least another 3.5 years.
Unless. And on that note, I thank you so much for joining us, Paul Waldman.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Waldman, who's a weekly columnist and senior writer for The American Prospect. He also writes for the Plumline blog at The Washington Post and The Week, and he's the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. His latest article at The American Prospect is At Last, Trump Finds His Mini-Me. Anthony Scaramucci perfectly embodies the Trump administration. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining Trump's reckless practice of government by tweet.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual
come, you masters of war, here that build the big guns, here that build the death planes, here that build all the bombs, here that hide behind walls, here that hide behind discs.
I just don't want you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration as the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
Good to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Larry. And what do you make of this extraordinary tweet that happened yesterday, catching General Mattis on his vacation along with the Secretary of State? Tillerson was also on vacation. Obviously, in spite of the fact that the White House said they consulted with senior military leaders, they clearly did not in tweeting out that he's not going to allow transgender Americans to serve in the U.S. military.
Well, you've got a couple of problems. First of all, you can't make policy with a tweet, because by tweeting it out, that's not like giving the Pentagon an order. And today, General Dunford, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told the people in the military, don't change anything. Continue the policy we have, which allows transgender people to serve. The other is the substance of the policy. I mean, even John McCain, who was adamantly opposed to opening up, for example, the military to gays over a decade ago, said, no, they're serving. There's maybe 6,000 of them. They're doing a great job. What do we, do? So you had two problems, and I think that's typical of the way they do. It's bad policy, and it's executed poorly. We don't know who he spoke to. I'm sure there are some generals who are opposed to allowing, transgender people to serve. But the fact of the matter is that those issues have been kind of put behind us now, and we're ready to move on.
Well, but what's the difference? I mean, there is obviously a difference, but if the president is capable of tweeting out a major policy change and not even consult the chain of command as commander-in-chief, what's to stop him from ordering a nuclear attack?
Well, that's the problem. And, you know, it's interesting. We had this situation once before when Nixon was in the throes of, you know, getting forced out of office. And then Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, told the Army, if you get an order from Nixon about, you know, using military force, don't do it. I mean, it was technically, insubordination, but I think it was the right thing to do.
So what is the situation then in terms of, we always take some comfort in the idea that we have adults in the room. And in this case, one of the adults, Mattis, was on vacation. We know that McMaster's had a pretty tough time. He lost out with Trump over Trump has ignored his recommendations to put more U.S. troops into Afghanistan. Trump apparently is toying with this idea that Stephen Bannon has put forth, which at the behest of these two private businessmen, the Blackwater founder Eric Prince, the brother of the Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, and the DynCorp billionaire hedge fund guy Stephen Feinberg. They want to privatize the war in Afghanistan. So he seems like McMaster's lost out on that, or at least Trump has ignored him on that. But at least McMaster's been able to get rid of one of the more important so-called Flynn stones left over from General Flynn in the National Security Council, this fellow Harvey, who's apparently a real... This fellow Derek Harvey, who's apparently a real hawk on wanting to go to war with Iran.
Yeah, I mean, General McMaster's made some progress. He got Trump to correct himself after he gave the speech to NATO, in which he took out the reference to Article 5. He got him to put that back in when he gave the speech in Poland. He has gotten rid of some of the more, you know, radical people on the NSC staff. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, like with this ban on, announcing that he was going to ban transgender troops, this is something that any president would have discussed with his national security advisor, particularly a military piece, and not to mention the Secretary of Defense. So he has some influence, but not the extent that he really should. And, you know, past national security advisors like Brent Scowcroft or Henry Kissinger had.
But he hasn't been able to, McMaster, get rid of the NSC Director of Intelligence, Ezra Cohen Watnick, who is a very inexperienced person who's got an enormously important job, who's apparently a close friend of Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. So there's still tension, I take it, within the NSC, because he apparently, that was one of the first things that McMaster wanted to do, was to get rid of Ezra Cohen Watnick.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And you know, one of the things I learned from my own days in government, and you hope that other people, if you take one of these jobs, you need to get it clear from the president that you will get to pick your own staff. But General Mattis, you know, he has hardly anybody in the Pentagon with him. Secretary Tillerson had his choice for deputy turned down. Mattis had his choice for undersecretary of policy turned down. So, you know, you need, if you don't do that, then you got to say, hey, I'm out of here. I mean, particularly Mattis. If Mattis were to go and say, unless you change, I'm leaving, I think that would just really turn the whole Republican establishment against Trump, because he's one of the sanest voices that you have there.
So apparently, last week there was a meeting at the White House where Tillerson argued with President Trump as to why the U.S. should recertify the P5+1 agreement with Iran that Obama signed and which Donald Trump has been criticizing. And apparently Stephen Bannon really humiliated the Secretary of State in arguing so vociferously against it. He apparently, according to that new book, Devil's Bargain, Stephen Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. I interviewed the author, Joshua Green, just the other day. Bannon, when he was serving in the Navy during the Jimmy Carter administration at the time of the failed hostage crisis rescue apparently has some kind of, that sort of formed a very anti-Islamic, anti-Iranian view. There seems to be a lot of Iran hawks. We mentioned that Derek Harvey's been eased out by General McMaster. But there are rumors now that Tillerson has told friends that he doesn't think he's going to last the year in this administration.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, he's been humiliated time and time again. And again, there's nothing wrong with having a vigorous debate with the president about a foreign policy issue. But Bannon doesn't bring anything, you know, to the table in terms. Yeah, he was in the Navy for 6 years, and you're right, he was there during the failed attempt to rescue the hostages in Iran. But things have changed tremendously in Iran since then. They've had elections, and you know, the great irony is, you know, people say, well, you know, Iran is doing this or that after the nuclear agreement. We had arms control agreements with the Soviet Union in 1972. You know what they did over the next decade? I mean, into Afghanistan, you know, for example, we didn't say, well, we're not going to have this agreement anymore because you've done these other things. This agreement helps the United States and it helps the world. Are there things that Iran does that you'd like to change? No doubt about it. But the fact of the matter is that this works. And the worst thing you could have, if you had a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, the Saudis could get the nukes very quickly if they wanted to combat Iran.
Well, I think it's pretty clear, at least to my mind, Lawrence Korb, that in 90 days' time, when Trump has to recertify the Iran deal, that he's going to cancel it. I mean, that's what I heard was pretty much clear from that meeting that took place last week, that contentious
meeting.
Well,
yeah, there's no doubt about the fact, and there are, you know, some Republican hawks on the Hill who would like them. They never did like that deal. Obama had to use a legislative trick almost, if you will, to get it through, because he didn't put it up as a treaty. And he said, if you don't like it, you need 2/3 vote, which, you know, there was no way they could get that. But even Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, voted against it. So, you know, basically, yeah, it is not a popular deal in some places, but it is a good deal. And it's not just with us. It's, you know, 5 other countries. And, you know, the Europeans are all upset right now about the increased sanctions we put on Russia without working with them, because their economies are much more affected by the sanctions.
In terms of their dependence on Russian gas.
That's right. And, you know, they wanted to work with us, and the Congress, you know, put these extra sanctions on Russia as well as Iran. You know, I was at a meeting with the Iranian foreign minister, Zarif, last week, and it's also been reported in the papers, where he said, wait a second, you guys, in order for us to stop the nuclear program, you're supposed to lift the sanctions. Not only are you not lifting what you should, you're putting more on. You're violating the deal. And so that's, as I say, the last thing we would want, whatever else you think about Iran, is for them to have nuclear weapons.
Well, it does seem that, just in the broader sense, with the pressure that Trump is putting on Sessions, trying to force him to quit, allegedly, or at least the suspicion is that he wants to fire Mueller. Now you've got the new White House guy, Scaramucci, openly attacking the chief of staff, Reince Priebus, and there's a rumor that he wants his job and might end up in that job. My sense is that this presidency is circling the wagons, and only the ultra-loyal sycophants, in effect, and the close family members are going to be the left standing if we're on this current trajectory. This seems to be becoming less and less of a professionally run operation and more chaotic.
Well, there's no doubt about it. And, you know, the president keeps making everything personal. And the fact of the matter is, we want to find out what the Russians did in the election. That doesn't mean it undermines his claim to be president or he necessarily did anything wrong. But, you know, obviously there's an awful lot of things that don't look, you know, correct there in terms of meetings and things like that. So You know, if he hadn't done anything wrong, he shouldn't worry. And if he has, then he ought to think about, you know, how to, you know, how to handle it. But, you know, there's no way that I think with the Republicans, if he were to try and fight, first of all, if he gets rid of Sessions, he's not going to be able to get a recess appointment. That's what he was hoping, so you wouldn't have confirmation. The Senate will just not adjourn. They'll keep one person there to, you know, prevent that from happening.
Well, as I mentioned before on this program, Lawrence Korb, to some extent this puts us in the situation of do we support keeping a relic from the Jim Crow South on the job, turning back the clock, or does Donald Trump escape justice? I mean, that's a hell of a choice, you know.
Well, it is, and it's unfortunate, you know, that I was hoping, you know, that once he got into office, he'd recognize that being president is a lot different than being a campaigner or a businessman, and he would, you know, act accordingly. And occasionally, as I say, when he went to Poland, the speech he gave was much better than the speech he gave before. But then he turns around and has a meeting with Putin with not only no staffer present, no translator, you know, at the dinner. And, you know, Putin is, you know, he's been in, you know, running that place for 17 years. He's a pretty shrewd fella.
Well, it is extraordinary, I must say. I've been trying to keep up with this guy, trying to cover it on a daily basis. I have several times lately I've had to call people back and re-interview them because things have changed so quickly.
Right.
It's an amazing, you're there in Washington. Have you ever seen anything like this?
No, nobody ever has. I mean, people say, well, you know, Nixon toward the end, he was acting, you know, a little erratically, but I mean, he didn't do anything in terms of starting a war with Russia or, you know, anything like that. And, you know, he was pretty smart guy. He had obviously his own, foibles. But, Trump does not even seem to want to play by any rules or any tradition. And, you know, that's, really, really painful. And, you know, he's got to get over this thing about he's going to want to investigate Hillary Clinton, you know. Can you imagine if George Bush wanted to investigate Al Gore, after the election?
Right. Well, Lawrence Korb, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate
it. Okay. Thanks for having me, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with the author of Burning Bridges, America's 20-Year Crusade to Deport Labor Leader Harry Bridges.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't going to study war no more. Ain't going to study war no more. Ain't going to study
I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down my pay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Peter Afasiabi, who is a founding partner in One LLP, an intellectual property litigation firm in California known for handling high-profile cases. He founded an appellate litigation clinic in conjunction with the University of California, Irvine School of Law in Orange County, California, where he regularly litigates civil rights and political asylum appeals with his students. He's the author of the new book just out, Burning Bridges, America's 20-Year Crusade to Deport Labor Leader Harry Bridges. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Afrasiabi.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
And people don't know about Harry Bridges, except certainly J. Edgar Hoover knew all about him. He was an obsession of J. Edgar Hoover, the former head of the FBI, the founding head of the FBI, I should say, who had an obsession, really, to put this guy in jail. And the way to put him in jail during the particularly during the 50s, although this all started back in the late 30s, was to call him a communist. So let's begin then with how this longshoreman labor leader from Australia got on the cover of Time magazine in 1937.
You bet. He appeared on the West Coast as a longshoreman, as a sailor originally from Australia, and rose to prominence within the union during the Great Depression when there were real battles on the waterfront. Labor had very, very limited rights. They were put into terrible working conditions, inadequate pay, blackmail, shape up, speed up, all that, that famous stuff from the Embarcadero and in the coastal ports. And he rose to prominence when he started speaking loudly with his Australian progressive labor beliefs that he had brought from Australia, demanding that they had to have a democratic union, transparency, and they had to be willing to strike to put fear into the hands of the ship owners and the employers association. And he had, as he started, the men on the waterfront literally just started to listen to him, and he rose to prominence even though he wasn't a political operative in the union on the sheer will of his voice and his demand that we must fight for our rights, and the only way to do it is to be strong and unified across the whole West Coast. And as he did so, he eventually led the Great Strike in 1934, Bloody Thursday. People were killed, and he came out of it eventually as a leader of the union with a mediated contract and real rights for the first time for longshoremen. And the moment he did that, the Employers Association, the American Legion, and other groups immediately cried that he's a member of the Communist Party in order to try to, you know, position him as that and frame him to trigger deportation proceedings under the then existing American law.
So he had a green card.
He, well,
what the equivalent was.
The equivalent. He paid a head tax when he entered in 1920 and so had the right to work here and live here. Yes.
Right. But he was incorruptible personally, right?
Personally,
honest guy, was not interested in money, fame, very modest. And he was basically hounded by a lot of corrupt people.
Yeah, I mean, he was hounded by corrupt police and private government agents working together to frame him. And he was a genuinely good guy in the sense that, you know, even at the height of his power when running the union, he was behind on his tax bills. He drove an old Ford. He insisted that the highest paid leader of the union not earn more than the longshoreman on the docks, the highest paid longshoreman. And so he never feasted on the trappings of wealth that many other union leaders, obviously, in other unions, you know, historically have. And that invoked part of the ire against him too, because they tried to bribe him to get him out of the union, and he refused to accept bribes and to step away from his sort of powers on the West Coast as he spoke and got people to listen. And that just solidified the anger against him and triggered this private public partnership to get rid of him.
And it's pretty amazing that he wasn't assassinated.
It is. I mean, there was an assassination attempt. The book details it. And, frustrated business owners on the West Coast got together and started having a discussion about how to get rid of Harry Bridges. And the topic of assassination came up. And one of the journalists from San Francisco was in attendance and said, hey, hold on, we can't do this. This is crazy. What are you people talking about? And they suddenly tried to backtrack. But the journalist, his whole life, was firmly convinced that he stopped an assassination attempt. There was another one when folks got together and tried to hire someone to take a police-issued gun to assassinate Harry Bridges, and the person reported it to the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. And the FBI's response at the time, and this was a little later into the deportation proceedings against him when they were in full force after him, the FBI's response was, that's out of our investigative purview, our jurisdiction. So they didn't investigate that assassination attempt.
And again, Peter Afasiabi is joining us in the studio. He's the founding partner of One LLP, an intellectual property litigation firm in California known for handling high-profile cases. He founded an appellate litigation clinic in conjunction with the University of California Irvine School of Law in Orange County, California, where he regularly litigates civil rights and political asylum appeals with his students. And he's the author of the new book, Just Out, Burning Bridges, America's 20-Year Crusade to Deport Labor leader Harry Bridges. So let's start with the deportation. There were obviously many attempts to deport him. And we, of course, have now, under Donald Trump, some serious deportation going on. Not that his predecessor, Barack Obama, wasn't deporting a lot of people, but it does appear that the Immigration Customs Enforcement are rounding up people that simply don't exclusively have criminal records, as they claim, but people have been, you might call it collateral damage, but people with families have been here for many, many years. families are being broken up. It's a very arbitrary and cruel system, it seems. So that's very much in the news now. So tie this in, if you will, to the current kind of zeitgeist.
You bet. The Bridges story really is one of history repeating itself when you look at where we are today, because the Bridges story unfolded in this legal and political and social ecosystem where the executive wanted to maintain complete control over the immigration system and assert complete dominance to the exclusion of the federal courts and to the exclusion ultimately of due process. And that's the story of the Harry Bridges trials that spanned 20 years with serial trials and traces the devolution of deep due process
and
the destruction.
That's what got you as a lawyer interested, right?
Exactly, yes. I mean, his case went to the Supreme Court twice, and in my 20 years of litigating political asylum refugee cases for folks like the folks you just referenced and political asylum victims from around from around the world or seekers from around the world, I've regularly cited his case because it's one that has some important language in terms of due process applying to non-citizens in immigration proceedings. And so his case set up this battle ultimately between the executive and the legislative that sought to deport Bridges irrespective of the facts, irrespective of justice and due process, and the courts that were required ultimately to be willing to stand up to the executive and tell the executive no. And along the way, many of the federal courts ultimately prostrated themselves to the executive and refused to bend to the sort of, to do what was right ultimately. And so they bent to sort of due process. But ultimately, the Supreme Court did stand firm for Harry Bridges. And so it's a remarkable redemptive tale of the federal courts when they're willing to stand against the executive in this very politically divisive, heated area of immigration. Fast forward 75 years, and we're back in a very heated immigration ecosystem again with executive orders, with Donald Trump demanding unfettered control over, what he wants to do in the immigration arena. And again, the courts are being called upon to stand up to the executive and decide the contours of due process and what's acceptable and what's not. And that theme of history repeating itself is part of what's fascinating about where we are today. And another aspect to how I backed into the story was really that I cited to this case in my own briefs with the courts all the time, and I wanted to understand the deeper backstory. And what's so fascinating about the Bridges case is our modern broken immigration court system that exists, much of the problem can be traced to some of the immigration decisions and laws that were enacted in response to Harry Bridges, because he won the first deportation trial when the examiner found that the government had put on perjured witnesses and tried to frame him as a communist. And literally 2 days later, Congress said, we have to, amend the immigration laws and retarget Harry Bridges. And that led to the new immigration laws in 1940, the Smith Act that was in effect for many years. But critically for us today, part of what Congress said is we have to remove immigration from the Department of Labor. Because until then, it was within the Department of Labor. Immigration was seen as a labor issue. And they said, no, we have to get Harry Bridges. We have to put it within the Department of Justice. We have to take labor out of the equation. This is a crime and justice issue, and the FBI has to get on the trail. And that's what got J. Edgar Hoover on, as you mentioned in the beginning, going after Harry Bridges. But that shift then moved immigration from being a labor issue now to an issue that's viewed through the crime justice prism. And so then you fast forward to 9/11, and our response was similar. We went back to that precedent and said, crime and justice isn't even enough. Now we're going to move immigration to Department of Homeland Security in this new system that was created. And now policymakers in immigration are obviously looking at immigration through an even harsher lens, terrorism, national security.
But arguably, the executive, FDR, followed by Harry Truman and even Dwight Eisenhower, they were sane, regular people, as opposed to the executive we have now who is trying to fire his attorney general because he treats him like, you're my personal lawyer and you let me down. You're not the government's lawyer. We have somebody that's just beyond the pale in terms of understanding the law and having basically pretty much contempt for the law.
Yes, and so today the courts necessarily as a result are being called upon to define the contours of the Constitution and due process and demand that we have law and order and a strict system of separation of powers, and we put checks and balances in place to control the executive in these in these journeys that are unconstitutional and really lawless. And the ripples are profound in terms of the damage done. And so it's true, back then obviously we had very different executive leaders back then in the White House, but still there was a time of great fear in society, and this political fear at the time of communism enabled them, politicians, that is, to whip up this frenzy and use it to achieve their political ends, and in the process have years and years of ideological deportation trials. And today, of course, we have different isms. We're not as paranoid today about communism. Today it's Islamism, Muslims, and you know, and these terrorism issues that get framed in those terms that create equal fear that obviously Donald Trump has mastered sort of the political you know, wins on, and it's going to require the courts to step in again.
Well, the book really does reveal a huge hidden history of what happened to this man, and as you pointed out so far in this conversation, how much it's affected our laws and what incredibly important cases they are, both from your point of view as a practitioner and student of the law, but also in terms of history. There were great lawyers that worked for him, starting with Carole King. And I guess on the other side, on the jihad side, with J. Edgar Hoover being obsessed with communists and wanting to get rid of this guy. Sometimes it was like the Keystone Cops, wasn't it? I mean, there was that incident where the journalists were able to watch the FBI guys across the street. So walk us through some of the good and the bad and the ugly in this story.
You bet. I mean, the good in this story really are the private defense lawyers. And as a lawyer, obviously, it's important to me to see these stories where it's the hard-fighting defense lawyers, many of whom are pro bono, fighting for the Constitution and due process and suffering much personal scorn themselves. They were one of them in one of the remarkable documents I found in my FBI FOIA requests. Footnote, the FBI still won't give me every document. But that aside, one of the documents I found that was really amazing is a document where J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI had said, in the event of a national emergency, Harry Bridges' lawyers have to be detained immediately. And that was just sort of a remarkable nugget. You saw how much the lawyers were under pressure and being, you know, pursued themselves. And that came out in the cases where the government lawyers, on the other hand, would argue to the jury or to the court in when they were bench trials that the lawyers were communists, the lawyers are communists, the lawyers are communists, and in order to get Harry Bridges, as if the lawyers' political beliefs really mattered. And so those private lawyers just fought to the end to defend their client against all personal odds. And that's a really important part of the story, I think, and it's one of the shining points of the story. Carole King, who you mentioned, was one of the founding members of the National Lawyers Guild, a fantastic pro bono legal organization that exists today. And Harry Bridges was represented by, you know, a real trial slugger in one of the most dramatic trials from San Francisco, Vince Hallinan, sort of a spitting image of Alec Baldwin almost, who fought tooth and nail with the judge in that case to defend Harry Bridges and had a really acrimonious relationship with the judge. And the lawyer there was ultimately jailed by the judge for his zealous advocacy and literally spent 6 months in freezing Puget Sound because he had too zealously represented Harry Bridges. And so the lawyers are one of the bright spots. One of the darker spots, of course, and the private lawyers, that is, one of the darker spots, of course, are the government lawyers in the saga, because government lawyers have all the resources of the U.S. government, especially in immigration proceedings. They have everything, you know, going for them. And they march under the banner of Lady Justice. And the official motto of the Department of Justice is to do justice, right, to serve Lady Justice. And what happened in these cases, as you see, is that the government lawyers shifted from that pole star, and they shifted to the pole star of winning. And when one just wants to win, as if it's a civil case, you know, you and I are fighting over who owns a piece of property, it's all about who wins, who loses. When that prism, though, is used by government lawyers in an immigration case, they're not necessarily serving justice. And so that's part of what the cases trace when you look at the bad and the ugly, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, trying to get put into evidence, you know, evidence that they knew was fake, quote-unquote evidence, right? There was a whole story in the book about this Communist Party membership card that they claimed was his official secret card that he kept and that had been, you know, stolen, and they were going to introduce it into evidence. And eventually it was determined by the INS that it was a fake, and it wasn't Harry Bridges' membership card at all. But nonetheless, the government lawyer still tried to get that before the jury or before the fact finder to paint him as a communist.
But there was, I mean, first of all, he eventually did become a U.S. citizen, right?
He did, yes.
And was it the Supreme Court Justice Murphy, was it, that exonerated him from the Supreme Court bench in a very passionate defense of Harry Bridges and a condemnation of how the government had treated him?
Yeah, some of the most powerful words written by a Supreme Court justice ever. He wrote that it that the case represented a testament to man's intolerance of man and was an institutionalized crusade. And those are Justice Murphy's words, really moving words about the subversion of due process and the illegal wiretapping from the FBI, the invasion of privacy, and the whole nine yards, really. And what's remarkable is even after Justice Murphy read those words from the Supreme Court bench, and as he read them, it's remarkable, he stared at the Attorney General, Attorney General Biddle, who was in court that day, and just issued a wrath of constitutional condemnation. But even then, the executive spent another 10 years going after Harry Bridges and instituting new deportation and proceedings against him to try to rid him from his American life. Ultimately, Harry Bridges prevailed and was able to become a citizen, and he lived out his life here, yes, but at great, great cost, obviously.
So let's just in the last couple of minutes then flash forward to today. Is his legacy understood in the labor movement, which, of course, the labor movement has been gradually eroded, and the Koch brothers, who have enormous power and influence, particularly over the Congress now, they're dedicated to getting rid of all unions in this country. They want to take the country back to the days of the Gilded Age at the turn of the 20th century. So they're down to about 7% of the private workforce now. But that's where I think the lesson is, isn't it? It should inspire people to understand the value of unions and how heroic, as opposed to corrupt, union leaders really can make a difference.
I think that's the massive lesson here, and it's one that when you read the story of Harry Bridges, which isn't well known enough, he's certainly known within the ILWU, his union, but within the broader union movement, within the broader progressive part of the political spectrum, his story isn't known enough. And it's a story of a man who came to this country with a set of beliefs and insisted that those beliefs be folded into American democracy. And he refused the trappings of, bribery and corruption that he could have readily feasted upon, in essence, and stuck to the straight and narrow and refused to back down despite 20 years and immense pressure, towards him and his family. He was defiant the whole time and dissented ultimately against the injustice and demanded that his political and his labor beliefs be incorporated into American democracy. And they were successfully. And so as a result, many things that we almost can take for granted today, Harry Bridges and his men fought for, and some of his men died for, on the streets of San Francisco, where they demanded minimum wage, they demanded workers' compensation type schemes and retirement schemes. And he specifically within the union demanded democratic, transparent unions that would never have racism within them. And he was one of the earliest proponents of absolute equality in a union. And he toured the communities to make sure that the black union members and the black longshoremen understood that they had an equal place at the table in this union, and it was not going to be a white union. And so that legacy is really, really important to know and to remember. And then when you paint it into the legal system, which obviously I'm particularly interested in as a lawyer and author, it's a particularly important story to remind us of how easily due process can be broken by those who have power when they stray from the straight and narrow, and how important it is to demand that our federal courts are willing to stand up against the executive when the times demand it to ensure that due process reigns supreme.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in the studio, Peter Afrasiabi.
Thank you very much. My pleasure, and my thanks to you and your listeners.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Afrasiabi, who's the founding partner of One LLP, an intellectual property litigation firm in California known for handling high-profile cases. He founded an appellate litigation clinic in conjunction with the University of California Irvine School of Law in Orange County, California, where he regularly litigates civil rights and political asylum appeals with his students. He's the author of the new book, just out, Burning Bridges, America's 20-Year Crusade to Deport Labor Leader Harry Bridges. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.